Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
This is Recode Media with Peter Kafka. That is me speaking to you Wednesday, the day after the U.S. government finally sued Google and then what will be a landmark antitrust case. I'm quite surprised and pleased that our guest was able to find time to talk to us because he's got a full-time job covering Google for the New York Times. Welcome, Dai Wakabayashi from the Times. Hi, Dai.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Like I said, you've been very busy because you've been waiting for this suit for years, at least
forever,
at least a full year. Yeah. We finally got it. You've been covering the hell out of it. We want to talk about what's in the suit, what's not in the suit, what to expect. Let's set it up contextually, first of all.
Sure.
This is the biggest suit since 1998 in terms of tech antitrust. That was the U.S. versus Microsoft. Why are we seeing this suit now more than 20 years later? Why has there been a 20-year gap in sort of major antitrust tech lawsuits from the U.S. government?
I think part of it is that in the U.S., in general, the sort of legal system in America has been reluctant to really go after big antitrust cases. If you look at America compared to a country like Europe, certainly the regulators here have not been as muscular or aggressive in going after companies. And I think now, often people say that antitrust is almost as much about politics as it is about the law. And so I think the political climate to go after kind of tech giants is better, frankly. And so I don't think the nature of Google's monopoly has really changed much in the last 10 years. But now I think the sort of external conditions are perhaps right to go after them.
Yeah, and we'll talk about both those things. And I wrote a little bit about the politics yesterday. This is a suit where you have Bill Barr and Elizabeth Warren lining up on the same side of the argument for maybe the first time, first and last time. And like you said, a lot of this stuff is sort of about Google's behavior that's been more or less out in plain sight for a decade or more. So let's talk about what is in the suit. Again, we knew the suit was coming. They've been working on this for a year. What is new in there? What is surprising? What did we learn from the actual complaint itself that they filed?
I think what we learned was that it was a much more narrow case than what we had been expecting maybe earlier on. There was a lot of talk early on that this might involve like search, involve digital advertising. So Google has the whole stack of digital advertising. And there was discussion that the DOJ case may have both digital advertising and search. And even within search, you know, there's aspects like local search. So this is like the Yelp issue where Google will scrape, has in the past scraped information from other websites and presented it on their search results. And none of that was really in the suit. It's a very narrow issue about search and sort of the deals that essentially help bring more traffic to Google.com. And so it was a very narrow case. And I think that came a little bit as a surprise to us.
What does that tell us? Does that tell us that this is the beginning of a suit and it could expand over time, or this is the issue the Justice Department thinks they can win on and that'll be that?
I think it's both is possible, but I think the latter is more likely. I think this is a case that is very similar, at least in sort of the contours, to the Microsoft case, which was sort of not only the last big tech antitrust lawsuit, but also the last time the government really won one of these things. And so they're really trying to focus on distribution. And so in the Microsoft case, they talked about, you know, how Microsoft was using Windows to help distribute Internet Explorer and how that was hurting Netscape. And so in this case, the government is trying a parallel case of saying Google is doing these deals that essentially lock in Google to all the other kind of main pathways to search. And that's keeping out the competition, which in this case is like Bing and DuckDuckGo.
So this is primarily focused on your mobile phone, right? A lot of discussion about deals that Google has with Apple to make Google the default search engine there. And then also with other carriers, also the way it uses Android sort of as a default, as a sort of a de facto default. These have all been out in public, right? There's no mystery about what Google's been doing. Oftentimes, Recode or other sites are reporting about the fact that so-and-so has a deal or has won a deal. What is the government argument that says this thing that you've been doing for a decade or more is actually illegal?
Yeah, I think that's a totally good point. And I think what it's in Google's interest to normalize this as much as possible. And so you'll hear them make the analogy that these types of deals are no different than when Coca-Cola strikes a deal with Walmart to get shelf space at their stores and to get the best shelf space. What I think is sort of maybe the sort of time element here is that how big these deals have gotten, partially because there are many more mobile devices in the world, partially because people are using search much, much more. And so as the size of these deals, as that kind of internet activity grows, obviously the numbers around these deals get much, much bigger. And so that goes to show kind of how valuable these deals are for both Google and Apple. And so I think that maybe perhaps raises the stakes of something that has been happening perhaps in the background that maybe not a lot of people, you know, have taken notice of.
Now, when you go into Walmart and Coca-Cola has purchased a certain shelf space or an end cap, right? That's a finite space. That means that Pepsi can't be there, or if you're really old, RC Cola can't be there. Mm. And in theory, right, you could actually block a rival cola company from being there. Or if you go to McDonald's, they have Coke but not Pepsi products or whatever it is. On the internet, you can use Google or any other search service you want. Usually, none of these deals preclude anyone from being able to use Google. Google has a dominant market share, but they don't own everything. This is one of their arguments. How do you think the government is going to sort of respond to Google's defense, which is, hey, no one has to use us. No consumer has to use us. And oftentimes, they swap different products out all the time.
Yeah. I talked to a couple of legal experts yesterday, and that was kind of one of their main that's going to be a big point in this case, is the notion that, you know, the government in their complaint has made a few references that, you know, that that very few consumers change their default option. And so they have to prove that somehow that it is very burdensome to change, or that it is, in fact, very, very rare that people change. Now, this in the 1990s in the late 90s and early 2000s, when the government tried to make a similar case with Microsoft, it was really a pain in the butt to try to get a new browser that wasn't like Internet Explorer.
Right.
So you had to go and you had to get a CD-ROM of Netscape, put it into your computer. If you didn't have enough hard drive space, maybe you had to like delete things. That is not the case anymore, right? You can change your default search engine quite easily. It's not quite one click, as Google likes to say, but I think it is. If you have any sort of tech savvy, you can do it quite easily. And so I think that's really going to be the crux of the government's case, is like, how important is it to be a default? You know, how infrequently do consumers actually exercise that choice to change when, you know, a handset manufacturer, a carrier makes that decision for you, you know, initially.
The government also says, look, what Google is doing here by buying these default positions, it's essentially buying itself all this data that makes its product much better. You or I were both on a Google call yesterday, and I asked them about that, and they said, oh, no, that's just not the case, and kind of left it at that. But
they said it was the method, not the data,
right,
that matters.
And so Google, yeah. And Google, in the DOJ case, over and over, they talk about sort of the amount of data Google is generating here sort of creates a moat for itself. Do you think that argument will hold up?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a very persuasive argument. I mean, I don't think any reasonable person can argue that having more queries helps you build a better search engine. It's just like anything in life, right? The more you practice it, the better you're going
to
get.
And particularly when it comes to machine learning and software, right? Like there's entire companies based on just get as much input as we can and we'll build a lead and then sort of figure out what to do with it later.
Yes, totally. And I don't discount that there is some kind of method that you can take, maybe less data and somehow build something that's good or equivalent. But I think that if you have already a great method, if you have more data on top of that, then, you know, your lead becomes quite insurmountable, and which I think is the reason why most people do prefer Google over alternatives.
So you said the government won its Microsoft case, right? They won in court, mm-hmm. and then there was a settlement, and essentially mm-hmm. not a lot ended up happening to Microsoft by the end of it. It went on for 6 years. What are the lessons that do you think both Google and the DOJ took from the 1998 to 2004 U.S. government versus Microsoft case?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Google, for its part, I think if you look at sort of the arguments that they made, that they sort of make, which is it's easy to switch, which sort of alludes to that issue that I was talking about earlier about how it was a pain in the butt to change your browser. They talk about how, you know, consumers are choosing Google on their own. You know, that sort of alludes to the notion that, you know, in the Microsoft case, you know, Internet Explorer was sort of selected for people, and it wasn't like people were making a conscious decision. And so I think a lot of the arguments Google were making to sort of fight this case are things that go directly at the heart of the things that help the government win their case. And so I think that, you know, that's been the lesson for the government. I'm not quite sure, you know, they're more opaque about what sort of arguments that they're trying to map on.
Speaking of opacity, relative opacity, let's talk a little about the politics of this suit.
Yeah.
So your colleagues reported that Barr was pushing to get this thing done in September initially, right? And certainly before the election. I've written about the fact that you've got, you know, Elizabeth Warren, who detests Bill Barr, calls him a corrupt crony and wants him to resign, but is encouraging him to go ahead with this case. Why do you think the government or Bill Barr thinks it's important to have this case filed now, as opposed to after the election, or even in a different administration?
I mean, I think, Bill Barr is really fascinating in the sense that, he's been really obsessed with this suit this investigation and this suit from the very beginning. You know, it's kind of hard.
And he's been clear about that. He's saying, I'm paying a lot of attention to this. This is something I am personally watching carefully.
Yeah, and he's been more involved in it than, you know, historically attorney generals would get involved in matters like this. I mean, you know, he's worked for a long, who knows what his true motivations are, but, you know, he's worked for a long, long time in the telecom industry. And as we all know, the telecom industry is no friend of Google. And I think it's possible that over these years, you know, he's had some very deep issues with the way Google does things, with the way they have competed with the telecom industry. You know, Barr was at Verizon when Google bid for wireless spectrum and effectively perhaps drove up the price of the spectrum that I think Verizon ended up buying, which is where Barr worked. And so, you know, I'm not saying that he's got this, it's like a revenge play, but there is certainly a sort of long intertwined history between Barr and Google.
And outside of the complaint, outside of the courtroom, there is a lot of discussion about reining in big tech. And then there's a conservative/Republican argument that says there's bias in the big tech companies and something should be done about that. Barr went on Fox News this summer and said there's anti-conservative bias and maybe antitrust is a good way to go after these companies, which I find staggering. But the suit itself doesn't make any reference to that, and I assume that is very much intentional. Do you think there's any way that sort of the external discussion about bias and discrimination works its way into the courtroom one way or the other?
I don't think so, because I do think, well, they just announced today that that an Obama-appointed judge will be the sort of judge for this case. So it's we'll see whether the conservative bias argument would do very well in that court. But no, I really don't think so. And even the DOJ sort of went out of their way yesterday to make clear in a conference call that aspect had nothing, those concerns had nothing to do with this case, and they will not play in this case.
They initially said, we're looking at that separately, and everyone freaked out for a second on the call. I said, yes. Oh, by we don't mean we at all. We mean Congress.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I think Trump also had some kind of tweet about how, you know, this is sort of the price Google has to pay. But, you know, I do think that ultimately in the court, it will be a very narrow case about the legal parameters of the Sherman Act and, you know, and arguing this from a pretty pure legal standpoint. And I think that, you know, bringing up issues like bias actually weakens probably the government's case in a courtroom. You know, it's one thing to argue that in sort of social media and on Twitter and on Fox News and wherever, but, you know, I don't think that that's going to help you much in a courtroom.
So Google has seen this coming for literally for years, right? And they've dealt with similar suits like this in Europe. You had a great piece recently about how on sort of the Google corporate culture, how you could say whatever you want, but there's real stricture around any discussion of antitrust and monopoly, and it's well worth checking out. How do you think now that the suit is filed, that this affects their behavior one way or another?
You know, I think it's funny. Yesterday, Kent Walker, who's Google's chief legal officer, and Sundar Pichai, Google CEO, you know, they both sent out emails to staff. And basically, Sundar's email was, stay focused, keep doing what you're doing, don't let this be a distraction. And then Kent Walker also had similar sentiments, but he also said, but let's not speculate about legal issues internally or externally, which is, to me, you know, keep your mouth shut.
Sure.
And let's not talk about it.
There's the not talking about it, but what about in terms of actual corporate behavior? I'm thinking about, you know, they've known this suit's been coming, but they've still been trying to, so for instance, buy Fitbit. I know that for years and years, you know, whenever they do buy a company, the idea that it could be blocked for anti-competitive reasons is always an issue. But they've continued to try to buy companies. You know, one of the narratives now about the Microsoft case is that that suit distracted Microsoft and prevented them from seeing the mobile revolution, and that's why they're nowhere in phones, et cetera. Google certainly has been thinking about this, and I'm assuming that they're sort of balancing, how do we not make the government angrier? How do we not screw ourselves sort of while the case is going on versus how do we continue to be as aggressive and dynamic as we want to be?
I think you're right. One of the things that Google has really learned from the Microsoft thing is that they think that basically Microsoft dropped the ball during the antitrust fight. They let it become such a distraction that essentially a company like Google could emerge. And, you know, Bill Gates has come out and said that.
Which, by the way, there's a counter to that, saying that's a convenient excuse for Microsoft screwing up.
Right.
And, of course, you'd want some other externality to blame for not understanding phones. But go on.
Right. But I do think that, you know, yes, Google continues to do deals, but they're not in that core search business. You know, if you really look, they haven't done a real deal in search for a long, long time, maybe because they don't have to. But, you know, also because I think that they realize that that's going to draw unwarranted attention. And so, yeah, you know, they do Fitbit, they buy Fitbit, but, you know, that's to help potentially, you know, their hardware business, which is essentially nowhere right now. You know, they buy things for Google Cloud and here and there. But I do think that I can't imagine them going out and buying like DuckDuckGo, not like DuckDuckGo
right.
to sell to Google, but like my point being, like, that's just not a deal that's even possible right now.
And so the timeline for this case is, they were saying yesterday, I mean, basically a year and a half of discovery, right, before we even sort of get to a courtroom. So we'll be talking about this for a long time, but sort of practically thinking, how long, what's a reasonable expectation to sort of start to finish for this case?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I think, you know, I think it was Google that said 12 to 18 months
yep.
of discovery. And I think that's optimistic. You know, they're gonna drag out everything. You know, they're gonna grind out every discovery motion. They're gonna ask for documents, and then they're gonna fight that request. And so, I just think it's gonna be years and years and years.
This assumes, by the way, that future administration continues the suit.
Exactly. And that's what I was going to say is, a former Google policy person came on Twitter yesterday and said, you know, now, mind you, this is from a Google perspective, right? He said, if Trump wins, he thinks that they'll fight it in court for years and that ultimately Google will win on the merits of the case. And then he said, but if Biden comes in, a new AG might come in, look at it, and realize it's not that strong legally and try to settle in a face-saving way. And that might mean a few concessions from Google and, you know, the matter gets settled quite quickly. And he's, you know, pointed to how when Bush came in, he settled, they wrapped up the Microsoft case pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Instead of fighting through all the appeals.
Yeah, I guess the other argument I've heard is if Biden comes in, he can say, look, this is a bipartisan suit. You can't argue this is political at this point. We're taking out something Bill Barr started. So yeah. We've got cover here. Although I've generally heard that people who want Google to get sued.
And I think, a lot will depend on who the AG is. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's like Elizabeth Warren, I imagine she's not going to back off an antitrust suit against Google. It just wouldn't be in her like brand. So, it'll be interesting.
What is the worst case scenario for Google here beyond fighting a long suit?
I think like a worst case scenario, the remedies are potentially the worst case scenario, right? So if you have something that breaks up the company in a way that is really fundamental. So either, you say you got to spin off Android from Google or something, or YouTube has to be its own separate entity. Those are all sort of the worst case scenarios. I think there's like middle sort of structural things that Google would be probably okay with. Like if the government said, all right, you got to spin off DoubleClick, although that doesn't really make sense now in the context of search. But, if the other sort of lawsuits that are expected about state AGs, if they say DoubleClick, spin off DoubleClick, Google would probably be okay with that.
It's interesting, right? Because Google is still, has tentacles everywhere. It's huge. It's in so many parts of our life. But at its core, the business is still that search engine and search ad business, right? So there's a version where they have to sort of separate themselves from the other stuff, but they remain almost as powerful as ever.
Yeah. I mean, that's the golden goose, right? That's allowed them to have their self-driving cars, and that's allowed them to have everything. And everyone in the company knows that, the search is the thing that pays for everything. And so it'll be interesting. I mean, I think the government's challenge is how do you sort of try to weaken search in a way structurally? And maybe it's to spin off Android so that, the link between Android and Google search is not as strong. But yeah, it's going to be a challenge. I mean, I think one of the challenges of this case is whether this actually changes anything for people.
Right. And that's where I was going to end up here. It's striking, and maybe it's just the nature of a lawsuit. Something has to happen and then you have to sort of investigate it and then sue someone because of something that's happened in the past. But it seems like this is literally a litigation of things that we were dealing with 5 or 10 years ago and just don't seem as relevant. They're enormously relevant if you're looking at Google as a search business, right, still. And but it seems like, if you were covering tech, I was covering tech a while, there was a lot of serious discussion about whether Yahoo could mount a real challenge to Google or if Bing could do it. And that's why Microsoft was going to buy Yahoo. And those all just seem like ancient history now, and that this is a settled argument. Mm-hmm. And it's striking to me. And I guess where you end up with does this sort of underscore the real divide here being, should the U.S. be more aggressive about enforcing antitrust rules, or does the U.S. need new antitrust rules so you wouldn't get to this point?
I think you need to decide, I'm not sure if both. I mean, they need new antitrust rules that are maybe allow them to be more proactive along the way. I think what is sort of what might end up having the effect that maybe the government wants, which is less Google, which is that, we might end up with all these different ways of sort of searching for information that's already sort of happening, whether it's, Amazon Echo, or it's, the notion of typing in a query into a box and getting a bunch of links, that idea has evolved over time. But, I can't imagine that that's going to be the principal way of us finding information 10 years from now. And so if the government creates enough friction for Google so that, you know, when they're, when the business evolves to the next thing, that Google feels a little handcuffed or can't really quite move at the same pace as everyone else, maybe that has, that creates the sort of consequence that, you know, the law can't really do right now.
Di, I want to leave it there because, as we've been discussing, this is going to go on for a long time. So we're going to have other opportunities to come back to. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Di. We asked him on short notice. I appreciate him hopping on. Like I said, we've got some time to cover this one, so we'll come back to it. If you guys have specific questions and thoughts about this antitrust suit or how we're covering antitrust and politics of tech in general, love to hear from you. Let me know. As always, I am all ears, metaphorically. Got some bonus content coming from you in just a second, maybe a minute. It's an interview with Julia Furlan, my colleague from Vox Media, who's working on a cool new podcast. We're going to talk about that, and perhaps we'll talk about my role in said podcast. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
In a lot of ways, the leader of Canada is not like the leader of the United States. Justin is 52, Joe is 81, but the two do share some struggles. Trudeau's been in office for a while, he's being challenged by a conservative populist, and he's struggling in the polls, especially with young people. But now, he's got a plan to fix it, all of it.
Among the $52.9 billion in new spending,
proposing a $23 billion program to get nearly 4 million homes built between now and 2031.
He's got a budget that speaks directly to millennials and Gen Z, or Gen Z as he calls them, and he's hoping it'll keep populism at bay in Canada too. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is going to join us on Today Explained to tell us all about it. Today Explained, Vox's daily news podcast, Monday through Friday, in your feeds.
And now here's Julia. Julia Furlan, welcome.
Hi. Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Thanks for having me. It's nice to talk to you again. Mm-hmm. I guess we should do disclosure first. We're going to talk about a project you're working on. This rarely happens, but I think I'm involved in this project as well.
Yep.
Is that true?
Yep.
Okay.
I got you. I booked an interview with you. I'm so honored.
Did I make
so
the cut? Honored.
You did.
Okay, good.
You did. So, fortunately, you said enough funny things.
Good, so good. So we're going to talk to Julia about her podcast, which is called
Go for Broke.
Which is about?
It's about, ostensibly, it's about moments in history where people sort of like get too excited about something and lose the plot and go overboard. So in this case, it's about the dot-com bubble. Season one is about the dot-com bubble of 2000 when many people, in fact, lost the plot and lost their minds a little bit.
And I'm so old that I have a reasonably decent memory of what it was like to be alive during that time. So that's what I talked to Julie about. This has great art on it because the sort of the main character here is the pets.com sock puppet. Did it have a name?
Actually, that's part of the strategy. They didn't have a name for the pets.com sock puppet because it meant that every time you talked about the pets.com sock puppet, you had to say pets.com sock puppet. So it ended up being an extra boost and sort of like a really smart marketing move ultimately because the pets.com sock puppet was everywhere. And it's become an emblem of the dot-com bubble in a lot of ways.
So this is why your show is a good show for people who like listening to my show, because it's a good combination of business history, finance history, bubble history, and cultural history, right? The idea
Absolutely.
That a sock puppet from a dot-com that no one had ever heard of was sort of created out of thin air
Yeah.
really quickly, and then within months is on the Macy's Day float and is doing Oscar spots
the Super Bowl
for Good Morning America. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, and the Super Bowl commercial. It's like, I think that one of the things that's interesting about looking at this particular moment in history is that it was that transition between things being like really easy to Google and find online. Like nowadays, if you research it, it's this couple of years where there's kind of a dead zone for the archival stuff. So it's been really fun to look at, you know, old archival articles and look at like old clips and sort of like look at this moment in media and tech and culture and say, like, how is it that a sock puppet that's a promotional device for a company that has yet to make a profit, how is that sock puppet on Good Morning America like regularly as a guest? Like, why is that sock puppet like mildly sexually harassing the hosts of this show? You know what I mean? It's so weird.
And also the idea that it's a reminder of up until just very recently, TV was the thing that drove the culture. The dot-com boom was very exciting, but what made it exciting for most people was they were learning about it on TV. And so it made sense to go take out a Super Bowl ad to promote your dot-com, or it made a weird kind of sense. By the way, as an aside, I have this theory that Google is really biased towards recency, and that makes it very bad for finding out about things that are older.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. Like that's something that happens in the research for this all the time, actually.
So you're working on this. It's how many episodes?
It's six episodes. I'm really excited about it because, like you were saying, like, you know, the media has changed a lot in the last 20 years, and so has the technology industry, and so has business. But a lot of the things that we're looking at in this series are like super duper relevant right now, you know, like
because it bubbles.
Yeah,
right?
Bubbles. And also, but also like larger things like, you know, you had Shireen on to talk about antitrust, and antitrust was a big deal even in the dot-com bubble because Microsoft had antitrust hearings against them soon at, like in the late 90s, before the actual bubble really happened.
But, U.S. Versus Microsoft, you're hearing a lot about it, like you just said. You'll be hearing about it this week, I think, because the DOJ is about to sue Google. So we're going to have a replay of that. And history doesn't rhyme, but it echoes. So there's a lot here to crunch on. What's the mix, do you think, here between business history and cultural history?
You know, I think that you can't really talk about the cultural things that I think are large parts of things without. So, for example, like it's hard to talk about the dot-com bubble without also talking about going back to the like deregulation in the 80s and how, you know, baby boomers all of a sudden were retiring and they wanted to and they ended up investing in 401ks and that changed the economy. Like this moment 20 years ago and 20 plus years ago a little bit has a lot of underlying things that were happening both governmentally and in economically that created that moment. So my hope is that you'll get the cultural things and the business history as much as possible. But like, you know, I also am really excited to look at the early social media. We have an episode that's talking about Black Planet, which I think is something that doesn't necessarily get brought into the conversation when you're talking about the dot-com bubble so often.
I think
often.
It never does. So tell us what Black Planet was.
So Black Planet was a social media platform that geared towards the Black community. It was extremely popular. It was founded by a guy named Omar Wasow, who is now a professor at Princeton, which tells you you know, which tells you like what the staying power of like being a tech entrepreneur in the turn of the right at the bubble was like. And Black Planet was actually this site that we're using as like a counterexample to the bubble because they were very lean. They didn't have the like splashy IPO situation. They were really focused on like creating an actual community, which is sort of like what the internet was in its early days. And it was really successful. And I don't know. I think it's an interesting piece of the story that doesn't usually get told as part of the larger history.
By the way, if you are paying attention to debates about cancel culture and a very specific instance this summer involving Black Lives Matter, Omar Wasow was relevant to that. So again, everything is always connected. One other great bit of trivia that I knew about, because I knew about the construction of the show, but I had forgotten about it until I heard about it, was the guy who was the sock puppet.
Yeah.
Do you want to do the reveal?
Sure. Michael Ian Black, the comedian that you may know, writer, you know, he has a podcast. He's sort of everywhere. He was fresh off the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles like live show tour and used his voice from that to become the Pets.com sock puppet and sort of like did improv as the sock puppet. And that was the main, like one of the driving forces of the Pets.com
so
sock puppet.
My memories of the dot-com boom are both specific and also hazy because I was inebriated for a lot of it.
All that free booze.
Yes. That's what we talked about in our interview is me going to a lot of parties as a young person because they had free things. Was Michael Ian Black famous for doing that, or was was he not? Did he not sort of want or get fame from that?
What's interesting about it is that for him, it was a gig. You know, like the things that he cared about, I think, were more his like visible improv and the shows that he was doing. But the Pets.com sock puppet, despite him being in the Super Bowl, like on a Super Bowl commercial, his sort of perspective on it was like, yeah, it was a good paycheck, you know, like, which tells you a lot about how actors are able to sort of like really own something, but also be like, nah, yeah, whatever, it's fine.
I did a whole piece, which is not a long piece, for Forbes about people whose voices were famous, but you didn't know their name. One was the guy who did the Taco Bell dog.
Oh, yeah, the racist dog, yeah.
I'm not going to weigh in on that. His name was Carlos. I can't remember his last name. I'll go get his last name wrong. But he did well. The guy who was the movie phone voice guy.
Oh, my God. The movie phone voice guy.
Yeah, which is a great story. And then there was someone else. I'd look it up, but I wrote it a long time ago, so it may not be on Google. Julia, we can get your podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts. The first episode is out now, and by the time you hear this one, the second will be out. So it's not too late to catch up.
Yeah.
And dive in. And if you want to hear Peter Kafka, that'll show up at some point.
Yes, that will be, I think, ideally in episode 4. So in a couple of weeks. But
perfect.
Mostly I'm just grateful to you for like, you know, helping me get the word out. That's how podcasts get popular. So thank you.
Thank you, Julia. Good luck and good luck with your internet up there in your undisclosed location. I'm going to let you go.
Appreciate it. Bye now.
Thanks again to Julia and to Di, to Joel and Jelani. Produce and edit this podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, and thanks again to you guys. We've got a couple action-packed weeks coming up, and then who knows what will happen, but we'll be recording through all of it. This is Recode Media. We'll see you soon.